For January the 6th, 2023, we talk about Life is Strange, True Colors, Just Dance 2023, Marvel's Midnight Suns, and much more. Welcome to Level 441. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Jala Brendez.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. And this is the first episode of 2023. Welcome, everybody.
This is my ninth year on this show.
Yeah.
Wow. That's kind of wacky.
I mean, this is the 10th calendar year. Last year was the 10th calendar year. We started in 2012. We're good at anniversary. We're good at acknowledging things.
Time is a human construct, and really, yeah. Who's to say how many years we've been going?
You know, celebrating isn't the work, you know?
Well, and then too, like, you guys were doing it under a different moniker for years and years, so whatever.
Yeah. Welcome back, Jala.
Hi, I'm here.
Yeah.
Happy New Year and stuff.
Yeah, how's it going? How is your break? What's happening?
What break? What break are you talking about? I don't get a break.
I just know. You know what I mean.
I am tired. That's perpetual. And anyway, I wanted to be on today because, like, I did actually play some games when it was slower and I was not completely exhausted every day.
Slower, okay.
Slower,
like a break.
Yeah. Not really, because I'm still sitting at work and working my full share and all that mess, but just not like completely drained body and soul. So, you know, the bloodletting was lessened a little bit. So
that's good.
Yeah. Anyway, I did play some games around that. So
cool. Yeah.
Yeah. How's everybody else doing?
I'm doing okay. My whole holiday thing was really boring. I actually managed. It took me several days, but I did manage to like relax and stop working and stuff. You know,
wow.
So I've got a game that I just played for me that I'm going to talk about.
Whoa.
I know, right? Yeah, yeah.
New year, so, new Cole.
Right.
So that'll be fun. And I always begin every new year after that break, having time to play for myself. So I'm like, man, I always feel better when I do stuff that isn't for a show. And then that zeal lasts for about 2.5 weeks, and then I'm back to being like almost always just a little bit behind.
Oh, so,
just a content pump.
You know. Yeah. That reminds me, I go to the gym all the time. Today, when I was at the gym, the first New Year's resolutioner to throw up, threw up about 5 feet away from me when I was doing my bench press.
Wonderful.
They were with one of the trainers, so they're fine. They were monitored and helped and whatever needed to happen there. But there are reasons I work out fasted.
Yeah, that makes... That makes a good deal of sense to me.
Yeah, they did clean up everything, and nobody treated this guy, awkwardly or anything like that. Because, like, we all know what it feels like to be there. I mean, not like necessarily all of us have pumped out our body fluids at the gym, but having the feeling of almost doing so, or whatever. Anybody who pushes hard has probably been there. So.
Yeah, you really don't want to go to do power lifts when you've just when you started the day with a full bit, big slam, grand slam breakfast at Denny's.
Yeah, like that's just it's I refrain from eating anytime near the time that I do any training, and that's been like years and years of that. So when I was running and running marathons and stuff, I would have something, but it would be like a smoothie or something, not like.
Yeah.
Physical food for reasons,
So. How long does it take for the gym to go back down to like regular population?
I have no idea, because you forget all of the time that I was doing all of my super bodybuilding and stuff. Like, I've literally never had a gym membership until last September. So I have no idea. But I also am there at 4 o'clock in the morning. So, there's not very many people that are New Year's resolutioners in at that hour. They come in a little bit later. you know, at normal people hours, I guess.
So. Oh, well, that's gross.
Yeah. So there you go. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yeah. No, but I just, my whole thing was boring. Ben, how about you? You said you got sick from traveling?
Yeah. Started off the year with a bang. I went to Midwest over holiday break, got to spend time with family, which was great. Got to spend a lot of time with friends. A lot of my friends are new parents, so I got to go to Union Terminal and hang out with a bunch of kids, which was a new and interesting experience. It was four adults versus three kids, so we had the edge on them. but it was still very tiring by the end of the day. So hats off to parents, huh?
all those new people.
Yeah, and then I flew back on New Year's Eve. I, for some reason, watched Schindler's List for the first time on the airplane. Weird decision.
Okay.
That's a terrible decision. Good God.
All right.
I didn't know when the next time I would have an opportunity to see it was, so I figured I'd go for it.
Most of the time. Yeah. That's almost as dumb as the one flight where I decided to watch the Mr. Rogers documentary.
Oh.
Was there ugly crying that occurred?
No. I mean, I did cry. I did keep it from being ugly, I hope.
Okay.
Not too many people stared.
So. I did consciously not watch Everything Everywhere All at Once for that reason. So
yes. Oh my gosh. That's really funny. How'd you like it? I haven't seen it since eighth grade.
It was good. A lot of like the historical stuff I did not know about, so I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. However, I'll make a call out. I do think the movie Come and See was more impactful for me. As a movie, I thought that was a better movie overall that does a similar thing. But they're both good movies, so it's not to completely nag on it or anything. But yeah. Mm-hmm. The Liam Neeson parts are like the weakest parts of the movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know. Ralph Fiennes plays a really good villain.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would say more, but we're not going to turn this into a Schindler's List podcast. So.
No. I'm just realizing it's pretty weird. Is it weird that we watched that in eighth grade English class?
Like it feels very intense for eighth grade English.
We had to get it was part of a whole Holocaust unit, but we had to get permission to watch it. And to have it played because it's an R-rated movie or whatever. And like, I remember thinking, you know, like, oh yeah, that's a pretty fucked up thing that happened, you know?
I think that's one of those ones where it's an uncomfortable movie to watch, but I'm not against showing that to kids, provided you match it with context and like talking to them about it.
Yeah. Like, and they did. My education as regards that was actually pretty good, better than I would imagine the average might be, but as far as like tact and sensitivity and stuff goes. Huh. Well, Dennis, how about you? How was Christmas and New Year's and all that?
Yeah, it was good. I watched a movie, but decidedly in the right way recently. Went and saw Avatar: The Way of Water in IMAX 3D.
Okay.
And dude, that just in terms of sheer spectacle, it recaptures what made the first Avatar so great, which is just like, I can't remember the last time I felt like a movie has just transported you to another place like that. And it's just really fun to be immersed in this like sci-fi fantasy world for what does not feel like 3+ hours. But you know, the plot's fine, character's fine, whatever. It's just a cool place to be.
Yeah.
You know,
you're there for the tech demo, visual splendor kind of stuff.
Yeah. Right? I'm here as a tourist to a fictional place, and there's like a pretty involved plot thing happening around it. But really, I just want to see the cool sea creatures.
Nice.
And see them you do. Notwithstanding people who don't like watching things in 3D. I think it's absolutely the right way to watch the movie. I think it probably has to do with like things shot natively for 3D versus things shot, kind of set up for it later. But all the previews that were in 3D looked like, you know, cardboard cutouts at different depths. Mm-hmm. Whereas the actual movie Avatar looked completely natural. in 3D. And I think James Cameron invented a new kind of camera for filming it or something. I don't know if that has to do with it, but all the things that I hate about what I saw in the previews and all the reasons why I think 3D is not relevant, just don't apply to Avatar for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I mean, that was a huge problem with like the glut of 3D movies, like in basically from 2010 to 2015 was you had like the Alice in Wonderland, you know, Tim Burton thing where just like, yeah, that you could tell they just went in and did like a cardboard cutout effect and stuff.
Yeah, not great.
Then you had Nicolas Cage in Drive Angry 3D.
Yeah.
That's a point of 3D's favor, though, right?
Yeah. Drive Angry, shot in 3D is the full title.
Ah, there it is. Yes. But yeah, there's just something different about watching an Avatar movie in 3D, and it's really, really freaking cool. You know, the movie was fine, but like as a macro thing, fine. Taken as like a series of vignettes, I thought it was almost more powerful.
Cool.
So there's a whole section where the bad human involvement on the planet is now hunting whales, except it's like sentient whales. And they do a very, very involved sequence just showing how they go about this and all the technology that goes into isolating and then forcing to the surface and then gradually killing one of these giant creatures.
They do just Moby Dick in the year 5000.
Basically, yeah. But you watch it and it just is gut-wrenching and feels wrong. In I think exactly the way that the film intends, that you just, you're seeing it from the whale's perspective, or you're seeing it from, being empathetic to that side of things. And it just, like, I don't know, it just hit me in a way that sort of discussion has never before, So I think it does little vignettes and scenes incredibly well, and tied together into a tangled knot of a movie, like anything that's 3.5 hours is going to get a little clumsy. But moment to moment, I just kept on finding myself being like, oh my God, this looks gorgeous. And oh my God, that one beat was amazing. So highly recommend Avatar: The Way of Water.
I am glad you enjoyed it. If you had fun, I can't take a shit on it. I find the Na'vi very difficult to look at is my problem. I just don't think the design stuff is very good.
Oh, you're gonna hate the water people then, because it's like Na'vi but slightly uglier.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I can, if you had fun, nothing I can do about that.
God damn it, he got away with it again.
I'm standing at the county line stomping on my sheriff's hat. Nice. Well, we've got a bunch of games to talk about today. I'm happy that everybody's new year was safe and safe and pleasant. And why don't we go and do the regular kind of show, what with the grind, the multiplayer, and the unboss, and we can get started with
The Grind,
where we talk about the games we have been playing over the past period of time or so. Jala, I'm going to throw to you.
Okay, I have a lot of games, so tell me when to stop and we'll stop, because okay. I'll try to buzz through a couple of them pretty quick. So I have continued to play Pokemon Scarlet. I finished all the gyms, Titan Quests, and Star Boss Guys. And I just have the finale of each of these to do. But to complete any of those, you have to be about level 60 to 65, according to the internet and other people who have played the game. And I have a couple of Pokemon that are in that range, but most of them are level 40 to 50. And I have zero interest in grinding up a party for the end bosses, because all of the end fights are ones where there's like a mixture of different Pokemon. So you need like a lot of different Pokemon to try to make your team and all of that. So Dave has also, on that note, changed his opinion about this game. He now says that Sword and Shield were better. So
that's good.
Yeah. So he is now, dancing to the same beat that I am in that regard. So I'm not actually sure that I will beat this game. It really kind of depends on if some of our friends, John and Desiree, decide that they are going to do a bunch of raid battles with us. The raid battles aren't as fun either, because like the Dynamax dungeon DLC endgame stuff from Sword and Shield was just so much more fun, because you had to go through like a whole dungeon and like you replaced all your different Pokemon with different Pokemon that you find along the way. And, you know, you have like this high level top tier boss to fight. And like in that game, you like all the ones that are embiggened, they are huge. They're Gigantamax, you know? Whereas in this one, they just get a funny hat and they're sparkly. And, you know, like it's not nearly as visibly, you know, visually impressive as the Gigantamax was from the other game. But also, like, I don't even know if I want to suffer through trying to grind around to get to see if they maybe add something like that in this one. I don't know if I'm going to do that or not. So the only thing that I have any interest in doing in this possibly is wandering around and trying to finish my Pokedex and like trade Pokemon with people, maybe. And that's about it. And I've had zero interest in doing that before. So at least that's something.
Right.
And it might be because the Pokemon are the size that they actually are. So there are really small Pokemon and then, you know, other ones that are really big and sometimes they're hard to see. So, and then like the overworld map will actually show you what kinds of Pokemon will instance in that area. So like, and it doesn't necessarily tell you anything about like when it does, because sometimes it has to be during a certain weather condition or a certain time of day. So you just kind of have to hang out in an area and see if you can find the Pokemon. And
or look it up on Bulbapedia.
Yep. There's always good old Bulbapedia. Bulbapedia, named after the best Pokemon. Anyway, so continuing on, I don't have anything else to say about Pokemon. Anybody have any questions about this?
Did you find any Pokemon nearing the unnecessariness of Flamigo?
I found Komala, which is a koala, just a fucking koala. That's all it is.
Cool.
You need to name it Harris right now, or I will be angry.
There were other people that on Twitter were like, I already named it Harris. And so I was like, okay, well, I don't need to go there. We already have other people doing that. I don't want to exert enough effort on that Pokemon to actually bother naming it is the thing. Like, cause I'm just irritated. But Flamigo was, outclassed by some of the other Pokemon that I got later. I did have like a low key desire to have like my ending team be all bird Pokemon, but I don't know if I'm going to actually bother with all that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have the energy for that. I can
so
play
many
other games.
Video games exist.
Yeah. I got so many other games. I did pick up Aviary Attorney. So like if I really want birds, I could play that. So
yes.
Anyway, any other questions about Pokemon?
Not on my end.
Great. So next one, Capcom Second Arcade Stadium. It's basically just a thing by which you can play emulation, old arcade games and stuff, you know, the end.
Cool.
Like, yes, you can do this on your computer. You don't really need to play it on the Switch, but like, it's easier and convenient and whatever. If you've got your Switch, whatever. So Dave and I played and beat Magic and Sword, which I had never heard of before. It is a Golden Axe type beat them up. And we also played a bunch of Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo and Mega Man The Power Battle. I have some other ones on there. We will probably play them over time. But that is what we played on the Second Arcade Stadium. I don't have anything else to add about that. It's a bunch of old games. Questions? Ooh,
they've got the Super Puzzle Fighter and Gem Fighter on there. Those are fun.
I literally said I just played a bunch of Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo.
Sorry, I was looking at the list. I was looking at the list.
Yeah. Okay. So in either case, we know how much Cole is paying attention. All right.
I apologize.
It's fine. That's just the way that we're going to start this year, Cole. It's fine. All right. So
this is why I don't ask questions about the games.
Moving right along. Just Dance 2023. I have literally never played a physical dancing game before, which is perhaps a surprise given that I have taken various forms of dance classes for the last 15 years.
Not belly even dance and pole DDR?
And... Nope. None of that. Not a one. Ever. So this is my first time playing one. I bought it and played it because it was on sale. the end. Like a friend posted that it was on sale and I'm like, huh. Mm-hmm. And so I got some little wristbands to hold the Joy-Cons so you don't have to like hold it in your hand when you're dancing. And yeah, so this is a longstanding dancey game from Ubisoft. This is the newest version. It is widely maligned for its emphasis on online services because there is now a Just Dance Plus subscription service. And the reason why is because Ubisoft intends to add more songs to this game rather than releasing additional annual installments. There's not going to be a 2024, etc., because they are just going to add on to the current game with new songs in the choreographies. So that is the new conceit, is that they're trying to make it a paid service subscription thing.
Anyhow, I wonder if that will work for them.
I have no idea. I don't know. Like at the like if they end up adding more stuff to it, and I don't like retro game some of the older ones and like them, you know, like I'll probably end up getting Just Dance 2022 and then see mm-hmm. how I like that one, and then. You know, if I still feel like I need more content, then maybe I'll look at the subscription or something. But like, I don't anticipate being like, oh boy, I just gotta dance every day. I don't know. Like, I mean, I'd rather just go back to pole class for all that. But anyway, it does contain 40 different songs from across the decades, including Disco Inferno, which was the first thing that Dave and I tried, and mm-hmm. songs by BTS and Harry Styles, Lady Gaga, a whole bunch of people. And if anybody out there is like me and had never played this type of game before, you hold a Joy-Con in your right hand, or you have it on a wristband, or you can also use your phone via an app and use that. And it tracks only what that one hand is doing. So if you really wanted to, you could sit down and wave the controller around and still score. But then what's the point? Because the whole point is, you know, acting like a goober and pretending that you're a diva or whatever, you know? Yeah. So the choreographies are rated 1 to 5 for difficulty, as well as chill, moderate, intense for the physicality of each of those choreographies. And you can sort the songs via a whole bunch of different aspects. How many dance coaches are on the screen at one time? So if you have like 4 people, you can do quartet songs. Difficulty, your personal rating. You can do ones that are just for kids and so on. But more importantly, there are also a bunch of accessibility options, including fully seated choreos, ones without jumping, ones that don't go down low, and so on. So if you have mobility issues, there are accommodations for that. Unfortunately, out of the box, there are only 2 seated choreos for folks such as wheelchair users to play out of the box. So one can only hope that eventually the online subscription will add more of those to give more accessibility. There actually is a dance coach as well that is in a wheelchair, and they have like all the different dance coaches. They're all like virtual, you know, models and stuff, but they are representations of a variety of different people of different body types, different kind of physicality, body shapes, ethnicities and cultures and so forth. Gender identities. They're all kind of represented there. So that is cool. And the songs run a gamut of different styles, of course. So like there's rock and pop and whatever. So there's going to be something that you like, probably. Dave and I first played this on Christmas Day, and I was surprised because it was actually cold that day and I had on sweats. And so I like we did Disco Inferno, and like as soon as I was done, I was like, OK, I have to go change it to tank top and some shorts. So, yeah, gotcha.
They gotcha.
Yeah, well, it actually was like, because I'm not just waving my arm around, you know, like I'm actually doing the choreography. And for me, that's the fun part because, you know, like I've done live dance workshops and stuff where you are learning a choreography, but it's like over the span of an hour and a half or something like that, or 2 hours, and you're learning a choreography start to finish in that time. And so like you're repeating sections and learning sections at a time and drilling it. So it's a little bit different than here, just run through this and have no idea what the hell you're doing, and then keep doing it until you get it right. But, you know, like, so it goes. It's still the same kind of brain work, you know?
Yeah. Looking at the song list, I just want to make sure that everybody understands that when she says it runs the gamut, it does. You see that they have Evanescence's Bring Me to Life. Okay, okay, good. But you can't have that without also having Linkin Park numb. So it spans them all.
And like newer releases and newer artists and older releases and older artists. And again, there's stuff for kids and there's like little woodland creatures and stuff. Like we did one the other day, was it New Year's Day? I think we were playing. And so we were playing and the first song we played, I don't remember what it was. It has Lyle Crocodile as the dude that you're supposed to be following, like your dance coach. And I'm like, this crocodile got some little short arms and I'm supposed to be paying attention to what those little floppy arms are doing. Okay. So I would not recommend that one in particular.
See, we have this and my kids love it. But as far as they're concerned, there is only one song. Which is Bangarang by Skrillex. And we'll just play that.
That's so funny. Dave was like, I don't want to hear that song.
Me neither, but I also love my kids. So.
Yeah. I was only pointing out those two songs because like just the, like those two together.
Yeah.
I mean, we were all around. We all knew what that was like.
So, well,
the dancer in those songs is dressed up like the guys from the, have you guys seen the video of the goth rave set to Thomas the Tank Engine music?
No.
Okay, now I need to find this and send it to you.
Yeah, now I'm preparing in my soul for that. But continuing on about this game, though, the interesting thing is that some of the choreographies include snippets of kind of story elements, and like the different songs actually kind of interact with, like the people from the different songs interact with each other. Like in one of them, the dance coach from Witch, who looks like a witch, is threatening the coaches from Walking on Sunshine's choreography. And then those coaches then, like, because at the end of the song, the song ends, they're all like posing and smiling and happy. And then all of a sudden in the background is the big witch character that's like, you know, looking like she's about to go use her big claw hands and destroy them. And then they dodge into a portal and go away. And then there's another place where a real ass human lady is just like watching a TV where there's like the little alien dude, blue alien guy on it dancing. And then she gets sucked into the TV Captain N style by the blue alien guy and then turns into one of the coaches that you are then like playing, you know, and following in the dance game. So the visuals are really fun, but they can also be really distracting and make it harder to follow the dance coach. So for example, in a few, particularly a couple that I know of that are Lady Gaga, the background changes and then the coach does a costume swap. And so it's kind of difficult to keep track of what's going on because like the background is changing and all of a sudden the coach has a different hair and a different outfit. And you're like, which one of these characters on the screen is the dance coach? You know, who am I following? I don't know what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
So, that's a little bit disorienting. But otherwise it is fun to look at. So we have had a lot of fun with it, but Dave's last time playing it was 5 or 10 years ago. So we don't have like the year by year comparison aspect to be like, oh, well, Just Dance 2022 was so much better in these ways. Like I can't do that kind of analysis here, but just as somebody who randomly picked up this game because it happened to be like half off or whatever, it's a lot of fun and I've been enjoying it. And so we will continue to be playing this one. Nice. Do you have that goth rave thing, Dennis? I need to see it.
Yes, it is in the Slack.
Oh, good.
Oh, I've seen other stuff. Yeah, I've seen other stuff set to that video.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very anemic rave, and I think in general it is you just set non diegetic music to it.
Yeah, it's the video of the goth kids dancing under a highway overpass or next to an embankment.
Yeah. And dancing is a very generous term.
It's not exactly the witching hour.
No. Now, you know, this is kind of similar to what you do in Just Dance, though. You know, so.
Well, I
not
mean,
that
like,
far off.
Not like, if you put your back into it.
I will say that there were a lot of times when, because like Dave and I were playing this together, it wasn't like he was playing and then I was playing and we were taking turns. So I didn't get the opportunity to observe him doing his thing when he was doing it. But there were some times when I would look over and, like, you know, there's a leg move and he's just standing there and moving his arm, you know, and stuff like that. Whereas, like, I'm actually trying to do, like, what the dance coach is doing, you know, fully, including, you know, if they're spinning, if they're dropping down, whatever they're doing, I'm trying to mimic exactly what I'm seeing, because that's what you do in a dance workshop and so on. But
this brings it full circle nicely. The way my kids play is they just stand and watch. Bangarang, only Bangarang.
that is very good. So does anybody have any questions about it, though?
What's your favorite song?
I don't know. I scored 5 stars on a bunch of them, and I don't remember some of them. Like, the songs that I liked to dance to were not necessarily the ones that I ended up getting perfects on, because it really just kind of depends on what the style of the choreography was. Like, there was some real slow song that was not my jam, but they were doing a whole bunch of, like, hand floreos and things like that, which is stuff that I'm very familiar with, and snake arms and stuff, which is very familiar to me from doing belly dance. And then they had some, like, slinky long movements that are things that I know from poles. So, I mean, it just was easy to do, you know? I don't know. I can't remember the names of any of the songs. I can, like, picture what they looked like in my my mind and be like, oh yeah, that one that has the 4 people, and I don't know what the hell the song was. And then Dave will pop off with it and be like, that one. But anyway,
sorry, some of the costume choices.
I'll have to get back to you.
Some of the costume choices for the songs make all the sense in the world. Like, you know, there's a Chihuahua one and she's dressed up like a Chihuahua and stuff like that. And then others, it's just completely off the wall. And it's like, well, this is a bug alien president, it looks like, but that has no connection to the song.
Well, yeah. I will say that there are a couple of songs that I like the outfits from or whatever. Like, one thing that I remember from the first session is that Dave and I really enjoyed doing Sissy That Walk, which is the RuPaul song. That one was really fun. We both actually got into that and were fully doing the dance number, both of us were. But then there was also Woman by Doja Cat, which Doja Cat's not usually my jam, but, like, this song is really, really earwormy, and the outfits in the different versions of that are so cool looking that Dave's like, I love those outfits. I just love those characters. I love the costuming and stuff. So that might be one of them. There was also another one that was like a Latin reggaeton kind of thing. I don't remember what the name of it was, and I really enjoyed that one myself. Dave was like, that was too intense of a thing, you know? And I'm like, no, that's why it's fun. But anyway, that's all I've got. I'll have to find names of things and tell you later, Ben. But I still have more, but I don't know. I've been talking for a while.
Let's see. Do one more, and then we should be good.
Great. So the last thing I'll talk about today is Samurai Showdown. So this is the 2019 originally released on PC game, released in 2020 for the Switch, developed by SNK, but published on Switch by Koch Media. And it's a weapon-based 2D one-on-one fighting game. So if you didn't know what that was already, there you go. The series as a whole is considered to be really technical, but it's not as technical as something like a Street Fighter, a BlazBlue, or Dragon Ball FighterZ, which that's another game I played recently, but we'll have to table that for like February when I'm back again. So anyway, about Samurai Showdown, the series is particularly noted as being adept at working with space via what are called footsies. So that is using certain traveling moves to close distance between you and your opponent while making sure that you don't get hit with a counter. So the play of this game is primarily about positioning, reading the opponent's moves, and then making sure to, you know, get your shots in whenever they make a mistake. So IGN referred to this as somewhere between Street Fighter and Dive Kick for this reason, because it's not about juggling or combos or block strings or frame traps. It's simple, but it has elements that invite complexity depending upon how you engage with it. So it's kind of like beginner friendly for a fighting game. but it also has some, you know, like the tactics are not involved in a lot of Twitch based stuff, let's say. So part of what also makes a fighting game fun is having a broad cast of characters with unique play styles. And this game does a really solid job of giving visual and technical variety. There's like a Kabuki guy. And of course, there's Haomaru, who is the main character. There's, you know, the whole gamut of different characters, like little ninja people and whatever. There's a bunch of different styles and different characters.
Yeah.
So compared to the PC, PS4, and Xbox releases, though, the Switch version is comparatively lesser visually, and the downgrades are likely to make sure that it still runs at 60 FPS.
Yeah, that seems important.
Yeah, so the backgrounds are more static, and they have a lower resolution, and then the texturing and outlining of the characters are duller. That's really the main places that you see those dings to the graphics. Mm-hmm. But it plays fine. It doesn't have like any real slowdown or anything from what I played. So and I played like the arcade version a little bit, but then I also played with Dave, and we were just basically picking random people and just like let the randomizer decide whoever we were going to be, you know, fighting as. So we got to play a variety of different characters. Every single match we had a different character that we were, you know, playing as. So it has the usual modes. So there's arcade, which is basically the story mode in this one, and versus training and online. The training mode is actually really robust because it includes aspects like hitbox and hurtbox detection and being able to record actions so you can learn the best ways of defending against certain attacks. Like you can record it and play it back, you know. Nice. And as with many fighting games, of course, the story is lacking. Like, you're not there for the story. There are some people who are there for the story, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did not engage with the online mode, but it's allegedly fine. It's workable. It does have some drops to it, but it's not, like, excessively bad or notably stable, like, super stable either. So it's just average.
Yeah.
But
It's funny, like, how many Samurai Showdown games had you played before? And, like, I guess generally, like, do you have a history with SNK kind of stuff? I feel like I've heard you talk about King of Fighters before. But
oh, yes. I like King of Fighters quite a bit. I did not play them when they were originally out on their home consoles. I played Samurai Showdown a lot in the arcade. I don't remember if it was 3 or 4, something like that. One of those I played a lot, and I did play it on home console. There was like another Samurai Showdown that was like a 3D one, and like it was the only 3D entry in the series, if I recall correctly. And it was very wackadoo because I tend to play more 2D fighters than I do 3D fighters, but I still beat everybody's ass on that one. Like I had at that time, I had like a group of people that I played like in person. We would hang out together and we would play fighting games, and like I just beat everybody's ass on that one. And I might be like, you know, evenly winning and losing against them the rest of the time, or, you know, particular people would just beat everybody's ass all the time, but I beat even those people in this game for some reason. So I don't even know. But so yeah, I do have a bit of a history with Samurai Showdown. It wasn't the one that I played the most. The one that I played more often was King of Fighters. So I have like kind of limited experience with the Fatal Fury games and Garo, Mark of the Wolves. I played a little bit of that, but you know, more or less I played a lot of Street Fighter. I played a bunch of random weirdo titles like Bloody Roar. Bloody Roar 3, for some reason, I had that, and I played that a lot. Marvel vs. Capcom, Capcom vs. SNK, that Capcom vs. SNK made me want to play some of the other games that I hadn't played much of, because I'm like, where is this character even from? Like, I don't even know. Let me go.
Generic guy.
Yeah. Where is this? Rival School? Like, okay, I haven't ever played Rival School. I got to go play that, you know, and so on, because, like, there's so many different modes in those. So
Now it's funny, like, what arcade games showed up in the places around you, like really dictated just like which series and developers you got into. Because like I can only remember one Samurai Showdown machine being in one arcade, and it wasn't even there for a long time. Like I like only got a chance to play it like twice before it went away when I was like, I'm talking like a little kid.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because this series has been around since 93. It's been around a minute, you know, but a lot of people just don't really, you know, haven't really engaged with it too much. But like, I remember when it was in the arcade, I played Charlotte a lot, who is the French fencing lady with the big armor. And I don't know, I played her a little bit in this one, but I was like, there are other characters I like better than her these days. Like, you know, like my playstyle has evolved. Imagine that since I was a child playing a game in the arcade. But I think it was because at that time it was like, I think it was Nakoruru and then Charlotte. And that was like the extent of the female characters in whatever version of game that was. And so like, I always tried to pick a female character. So the one that I stuck to was Charlotte for whatever reason. But I think it's because Nakoruru just has like the super chibi voice, and I was just not down for the, you know, little girl.
A little obnoxious.
Yeah.
You don't want to main someone with a grating voice.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to hear that. So it's kind of like, I never played Morgan in Darkstalkers because her voice, when she's like, aha! And I'm like, okay, I cannot with that laugh.
That sound haunts me. There was a Darkstalkers machine at the bowling alley where my family used to go, and like that just pierced no matter how far away you were from it.
Absolutely. I would play Lilith though. I like Lilith. She was fine in Darkstalkers 3, but like, I was really not into Morgan. And it's solely because that voice, like Shadowbreed. Like, oh my god.
Yeah.
Enough of that. Enough of that.
Little much.
The end. That's all. I'll stop there. We'll talk more about other things another time. Someone else.
Okay. Ben, you've got one you've been waiting a while to put in the books.
Yeah. All right. I got you. I also have four games to talk about. I'll try and go through as quickly as possible. First one is Midnight Suns. I'm going in chronological order for me. I finished this before Christmas break, so like maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. I think I was close to completing it the last episode we did. It's good. The narrative sucks. The gameplay is good. So it's like an XCOM game, essentially. But usually XCOM, the narrative is actually not that bad. So I shouldn't even say that. But I mean,
the narrative is appropriate to the type of game.
Yeah.
And also, like, the narrative is the aliens are on their way and we've suffered a number of setbacks, and those setbacks are the missions. And then the aliens show up and then you deal with them. What I have heard about this is just like from the, you know, I know Gary finished this. I know that Jeremy finished it. Both of them are just extremely shocked by how much talking there is in it.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. I was skipping through like entire, not just lines that people were saying, but like entire like cinematics by the end of it, where it's just like, I'll figure it out when we get to the other side. It's like,
you're here for the combat, which I understand is really, really good, even based on what you said before.
Yeah, the combat's good. It's good deck building. It's pretty like simple. This really reminds me of like vanilla XCOM, where it's like, this is a great germ of an idea for a game. Now, like, iterate on it. Like, please make a sequel. Please make an expansion. Like, add to it. And, yeah, hopefully figure out the narrative. I'm curious. Like, I feel like probably their hand was, like, forced on this a little bit, where it's like, if we're paying for all these really iconic characters, we should put them on screen a bunch. And they should have, like, a lot of screen time and make jokes and stuff like that. It just doesn't really land completely well, though. Like, I personally didn't care about any of the characters at all. Like their motivations were, they were there, I guess, but they weren't really compelling. I don't know. But the gameplay is really fun. The base aspect is great. Like they killed it on that. So it's, again, it's like a Firaxis game. So they're living up to their standard in that dimension, at least. So yeah, that's pretty much all I have to say about it. If you liked like XCOM games, you'll enjoy the game. The narrative is very long and a little bit wordy, but whatever. Next thing I'm going to talk about is one that I played when I was back in the Midwest. I played Modern Warfare 2. This was on my brother's PlayStation that he has. And so he plays like the multiplayer stuff. I played the single player campaign. I got close to the end, but I didn't finish it out and I had to leave. So that's where I'm at. It's fine. I do have like
positive... What machine is he on? Can you do like remote play?
Maybe. It's not a huge deal if I don't play Last of Missions. It's a good game. I was surprised. They kind of went the route where they wanted to make a short game, but have pretty quality missions on it and pretty good spectacle on it, the same way that the original Modern Warfare was. And so the missions are very diverse. They do a lot of interesting things with them. I was pretty consistently surprised on missions where it's like, oh, we're going to do that now. That's crazy. And yeah, so they added a lot of like new features. They might have done this in the games between the last one I played and this one, which is like a decade ago. So that's probably the case. But yeah, I was really impressed with it. I was impressed that it was a like short and sweet campaign, and it wasn't like the dumb like America hoorah type stuff that was in like I think Modern Warfare 3, which is where I checked out. It was more just kind of giving you these kind of like, as Dennis used the word, like vignettes of different like action scenes of like that you would find in movies, but strung together with a consistent storyline. So
I heard it said that like they kind of disguise the hoorah and less like, oh, America's awesome, into like, oh, our team, our squad is awesome. And it's like this, you know, combat buddy porn where,
sure,
you know, you're all like, these are lifelong friends that think each other's thoughts and move in perfect unison. And you can get behind that, even if you're like, but you're still kind of war criming.
Yeah.
As long as they're not nationalist about it, then I'm okay with it.
what era does this take place in?
It's modern times. I don't think it's
right there in the name. Jeez.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
But it's not like some of the previous ones where it's like 5 years in the future or anything like that. It's not explicitly like that. You know, if it is like that, they didn't lean into it too hard. So,
yeah.
So I would say that like, as far as like, sometimes I like to give price like recommendations for this. Like this is a good like $20 to $40 game, just the single player part. So if it's on sale, totally worth it. If you really enjoy multiplayer, then who knows, probably full price might be worth it for you. But I played like zero of that, so I can't talk about it. But I'm going to keep on trucking.
Okay.
The next game I played might be a cry for help, as I picked up Marvel Snap and started playing that a few days ago.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, it just like, as long as you're not moving closer to magic, you might be okay.
Yeah. This is, I was basically looking for something like magic. So I figured I'd try this out. And I have a couple of friends who played it before. It is pretty good. It is a very simple to learn game, but it has a lot of good interactions that make it really interesting and compelling. The premise of summary of the game is you play these very quick matches between people where you have six rounds, and each round you have as much mana as the round number, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And you draw a single, you start with three cards, you draw a single card per round, and you play however much you want, round over round. So, you know, you have a limited amount of mana, so you can only play so much. You build a 12 card deck. There are no duplicate cards. And that's what you draw from. And when you play cards, you have a battlefield that's like three different spaces, and each card you play has power and some effect. Whichever area, whoever has the more power at a given area, they win it at the end of the round. If you win 2 out of 3, you win the game. And that's the, I don't know if that description makes sense or not, but that's the basic rules of the game.
I mean, it really does. I mean, you said it was made for short rounds, but like, is that momentum system, is that unique to this? Like where your mana count is the round count? Is the round number?
Hearthstone does that.
Yeah, Hearthstone does it. Magic kind of does it, but they don't explicitly do it. The idea is you can play a land every round, so that's kind of your increasing mana.
Okay.
But then this is supposed to be an improvement on that, because in Magic you can either flood or, I don't know, the opposite, get mana screwed, I think. So this kind of alleviates that sort of problem where it's like, okay, we're taking all the lands out of your deck and we're just going to give you a mana every round. Mm-hmm. The weird trade-off is like, that's also a positive though in Magic, is like having more complicated costings is another way to balance things. So it's like, if this costs three swamp mana or whatever, then you can have it be a stronger effect than like a basic three mana card because it's more specific. Anyway, that aside, yeah, so it's a mobile game. You can definitely tell that because it's free to download. After about a day or two of playing consistently, you hit a wall where it's like, well, I can put money into this if I want to keep progressing, or I can just play at this really slow and tedious pace that I've like burned down to.
I heard money stuff was only cosmetic. It sounds like that's wrong.
No, yeah. Basically what happens is the progression in the game is for every card, there's basically tiers of how pretty the artwork is. So you unlock a card. It's a basic card. It looks unimpressive. If you upgrade it once, you get a like a border pop out, like in the comics or whatever, so that there's silhouettes outside the borders of the card. If you upgrade it again, it gets 3D, so like you can turn the card and the background like shifts. And then if you upgrade it again, it's animated. And if you upgrade it again, the title is animated. And so this, it sounds kind of dumb, but it's like basically the card looks prettier and prettier as you update it. But to do that, you have to invest like their fake economy into it. So you have to spend like blue bucks to do this. And then every time you do it, you upgrade on this green track. And then that can give you unlocks that unlock other things. There's like three or four systems that are like completely disparate and like not intuitively interlacing with one another. And so it's kind of like this like maze where it's like, okay, I guess I put money into it here and maybe I could do this thing if you wanted to do that. I'm refusing to put money into it, so I'm not going to do that. But
good man.
Yeah. But that said, you can still unlock. I could probably have like 100 to 200 cards like unlocked already. So you do get a good bit. And they do a good job of matching you against people who are at like power levels, because you can watch streamers who have unlocked like everything and their decks are nuts. And then, like, I'm playing people where it's, like, I have a basic synergy to my deck, and it's, like, okay. It's fun to try and build different archetypes. It does get to the point now, though, where it's so slow to unlock new cards that the decks are kind of, like, starting to kind of be formed up, and there's not a lot of, like, experimentation anymore, which is a bit of a bummer, because that's, like, the more main point of joy. So I think I could see myself probably falling off of this pretty quickly, just because I don't want to put money into it. But that said, the game itself, the base game, is really good. The one thing I forgot to mention, the three different areas like that you put your cards on, they are hidden at first, and in rounds 1, 2, 3, they are revealed from left to right. They all have a random effect. So one of them might be like on round 4, you're going to shift all your creatures one space to the right if there's room. Or one of them might pop up and say, hey, everything's one cost cheaper this game. Or it might say you can't play anything here on round 6. Just random effects like that. And so that makes it a little bit more interesting, because sometimes it'll work with a synergy you might have, and sometimes they might completely like negate a synergy that you're trying to go after. So you have to try and play around those types of things.
Yeah.
So highly interactive. That part's really fun. I think the last thing I'll mention is they have like a backgammon betting system on top of it for anybody who's avid backgammon players. At any time, you can double the points of the game. So, and that's what they call snapping. But a game is worth 2 points. But if at any time you back out, you only lose 1 point. However, at any point in time, somebody can double the points of the game. And you can either accept that, and then the points are doubled, so that if you back out, you lose 2 points, but it's worth 4 points at the end of the game. And then the other person can double as well at any point in time. And if both people double, then it's worth 8 points, or you lose 4 points if you back out. If you go to the end, you lose 8 points.
That's really embarrassing for them.
Because
the naming it snapping, because snapping is supposed to have things, not double them.
Yeah. Good point.
Can't believe that one made it through.
Yeah. Hope somebody got fired for that blunder.
So that part makes it interesting too, because like you don't want to scare someone away. So if you're like overtly like killing them, if you snap, they'll probably run away if they're really good. So it, or you can try and do it early on. Like if you pretty sure you're going to win, but it's like round one or two, you can try stepping then before they've seen the cards that you're going to play. And then that way it's worth more points for you. And you use that to rank up. And then it's like any other like multiplayer game where there's like bronze tier, silver tier, gold tier, platinum tier, blah, blah, blah. And you can get unlocks if you reach any of those tiers. But
That's probably the most interesting system that the game offers. Like, you know, shortened up version of a card game, that's great. But that's an idea, the like, you know, at the game level, I can raise the stakes at any point that I have not seen in any other collectible card game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They stole it from Backgammon, I swear.
Yeah. Not a card game that I'm aware of.
True, true. But yeah, it's a pretty fun game. I don't think it has the legs necessarily unless you put money into it. And so maybe some people are there for that, but I am not. So, yep. That's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, well, stay strong.
The last tiny one I want to mention is I have kept playing Returnal. And I think the last time I talked about it, I had beaten the first boss and gotten to the second biome. I think now I've gotten to the third boss and I'm on the third biome. I haven't beaten that yet. It's cool. Once you get the hang of things, it feels really good. It has a similar feeling as Dark Souls, where once you've learned the enemies and their moves and stuff like that, and you like understand how to fight them and everything, you just breeze through levels in a way that were so frustrating when you first got there. Yeah. I think of those fucking guards and that one city, Undead Burg or whatever, owning me at the start of that game and then just running right by me when I was like competent in the game. Anyway, it has that sort of feeling. It's still a really beautiful game. It's really, like, again, I keep comparing it to the one game Scorn that came out because it's, like, such a polished version of that idea that I'm just really impressed that it's not sold as that, as being, like, the type of game it is where it's like, oh, this is, like, the best Alien game that's been made, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not Alien explicitly.
They did a pretty poor job of, like, selling the game conceptually when it was first coming out. Like, I mean, especially when it was announced, I remember people being like, okay, so is it Dead Space Dark Souls? Like, what's going on?
It's a hard sell in general, too, because it's like the runs that you go on are like 1 to 2 hours per run, you know?
Yeah.
And it is a tough feeling going into a boss being like, I know I'm not going to beat him on the first try. I literally am just doing reconnaissance for what their moveset is to try and think about how I can not die next time. Yeah. That's a bad feeling, but it's but it's cool. Like, as you beat bosses, you get pretty powerful abilities. And the reason why they're powerful is like, all the maps basically have these like hidden things that are kind of barricaded by these abilities that you have. So like, as you beat the bosses, you're getting a more full experiences of all the areas that you've been through already. So that I think that piece makes it more and more fun as it goes on, where it can be a real slog the first, like the first boss, cause you don't get any of that. But, so I really like it. We'll see if I can make any progress on it in the next week or two, but I'm very curious to see where it goes. Everyone who has beat it said the story's really good. The story's interesting so far. It's a lot of like what the fuck's going on sort of stuff, but not a lot of answers yet. Just a lot of questions. So
yeah.
Yep. That's all I got.
Nice. Dennis, I'm going to move on to you.
Sweet. Well, the big one is enabled by my new PC that I got for Christmas. Hooray! I think I've talked about before, I've been sitting on these parts since Black Friday, just been torture, and opened them on Christmas, acted appropriately surprised for my kids, and then spent the morning building the PC while my kids played Mario versus Rabbids Sparks of Hope. So it was a good time. And miraculously, everything worked on the first try.
Yay!
That's impressive.
So yeah, I kind of was bracing myself for that not being the case, but we're a couple weeks into the new PC and it's all going well. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I've got this new powerful machine. It's a RTX 3070 in the graphics department now. So I needed a game to put it through its paces, which led me to Elden Ring.
Welcome, friend.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
I'm taking the plunge. And so I am reporting in, just for context, people familiar with the game, from just after the Castle Stormbell section.
Okay. Have you gone south yet?
No, I've gone way east.
So you've gotten to so you've probably seen and bounced off of Caelid?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I got to the Finger Reader in the east, and she told me there were two places I could go. Mm. And then I turned around and kind of went back into Limgrave and derped around with some stuff that I missed earlier.
Okay.
If I can make a recommendation to you, heading south, from the lake where the dragon shows up there, heading south to the Weeping Peninsula sooner rather than later will be good. Just because you don't want to go to that place over leveled. It's a weirdly signaled like midway step between Limgrave and Stormvale.
Okay. Yeah, I think one of the places that the Finger Reader told me about was south, so that's helpful to know. Mm-hmm. Which is funny. It's like, okay, here's options for where to go.
Yeah.
guess you did narrow it down, thank you, but still sure.
So you cleared Stormvale, you beat Godric at the Grafted. How'd you like that how'd you like that fight?
Oh my God. The Dark Souls at its best. The Soulsborne series has a very good bead on what makes for a fun and challenging boss fight. Mm-hmm. And they really kind of flexed that in this one. And I really appreciate, I feel like these bosses talk more than any in the previous entries have done. And I think that's it's not a lot, but it is just enough to add just a little extra bit of badassery to it.
Yeah. What level is your character?
I appreciate that.
And what character are you rolling as?
I think. So I did. It's the Dex build. Bandit.
Bleed.
No, not bleed. He starts with dual wielded swords, dual wielded scimitars. Maybe
I can never remember what the starting classes are named.
Yeah, I mean, it's so meaningless anyway. but it was like, yeah, this guy looks cool, and I kind of had in mind, I'm just going to start with a Dexy kind of build, which is a little bit like the small guns talky. I feel like for Soulsborne games, for me anyway. I know that there's wide variance on that.
Dex is a good way to run an Elden Ring because bleed is very overpowered.
Yeah. Lots of, and it's so many things that I find right now build up bleed. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's just they decided it was kind of a base thing that a lot of weapons would have, or I've just, you know, lucked into a bunch of bleed centric stuff. But yeah, go figure. But yeah, I honestly, my first impression, you know, after the, you know, 10 or so hours that I've been playing, is I feel like I'm playing two different games.
Okay.
There's Limgrave and there's Stormvale. And the two, neither of them are bad. Both are very good, but they almost feel like they don't talk to each other in a weird way.
Yeah.
The way I move through them, the way I interact with them is just completely different.
Yeah. I mean, like when you're in the, you know, the actual designed dungeons, I mean, even more so than like the kind of the mini dungeons you go to, you know, anything called a catacomb, anything called, you know, cave or something like that. Like those are particular kinds of like biomes that you go into when you are in what they call the legacy dungeons. It feels very much like a classic Dark Souls game, just with a jump. Everything else is kind of built around the open world where you're still doing Dark Souls type stuff, just with the addition of, you know, the mount kind of thing.
Yeah. You mentioned the jump. So two questions for you. What is the latest point of the game at which you have forgotten you have a jump and B, forgotten that you can just warp back to a bonfire in almost any situation?
So the warp thing never goes away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I will still sit down at a site of grace / bonfire and look for the warp. Like, okay, so where's teleport? No, you can do it just from the map. You're fine. The jump ends up being so important for exploration. You know, and I think that Stormvale actually, for me and for people that I've talked to, it did a very good job at kind of hammering home with what jump has done to the level design in terms of getting to stuff. I never forget that I have it because it's also like an alternative way to avoid attacks, and jump attacks end up being very powerful.
Speaking of jumping hammers, I never forgot about jumping because that was my build. So
yes,
got it. Okay, that's very fair. Yeah, I feel like the jump, it fits surprisingly naturally into this kind of game. It is. I literally had this thought, like, it is a very Dark Souls jump.
They
like,
had
it feels kind of clunky, you know, like. Yeah.
And they like had they had practice to it. They didn't just go from Dark Souls 3 with no jump to Elden Ring with jump. Sekiro was kind of built around jumping as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, nice. Yeah. I haven't played that game, so I don't have that as a point of reference. But in general, I found it didn't feel like it changed the level design. And I speak of that saying I love the level design of Soulsborne games. Like, you know, it's exactly what I want. Assembling a space in my mind, being afraid of what's around every corner, etc. It just shifted what I was looking for up about 3 feet. You know?
I mean, like, it didn't shift everything up. It expanded what you might be looking for upward 3 feet.
Right. Expanded the range of what I was looking for. That's a good way to say it. But it's still that kind of like, oh, that looks like I might be able to, well, maybe this ledge, you know, goes to a secret item that I can kind of, and then you realize, oh no, this is an entire other area that is going to take you about an hour to explore and has its own boss. Mm-hmm. Like that's the Souls experience. And you know, doing that through jumping, feels just as good. Mm-hmm. I haven't messed around with it in combat as much. I find I'm as likely when I'm on a ledge to just fall off of it and attack as jump off of it and attack. And I don't know if that changes what attack you do.
So. I mean, there's the drop attack, which is its own separate thing. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm thinking specifically. So like in previous Souls games, you would achieve this by pressing forward and circle at the same time, and then shortly after that, pressing R2 to do a strong attack. That would with most weapons do like a leaping forward attack. Here, because you can jump at will and you don't have to do the weird like dodge jump kind of thing, you achieve the same thing with more flexibility by just attacking during a jump.
Yeah And let's see. Oh, weapon wise. So I told you I was going a Dexy build. I found the Wolverine claws. I think it's called the Hook claws on. And I was just like, yeah, this feels fun. So I'm going dual wielded Hook claws.
Ooh,
that's dope. And that has worked pretty well for me so far. There are certain enemies it's a little dicey against, just like, you know, quick flurry of attack enemies. So I do carry a light shield that I'll switch to in certain instances, but the majority of the time I'm dual wielding. And yeah, that's very nice. I don't know if it's because I put points into stamina early, but I don't feel like running out of stamina has really been a problem.
Elden Ring, the stamina game is very different. You just have way more as a baseline to begin with. And kind of only run into it in boss fights where you're dealing with longer combos.
Yeah. So that has benefited my decision to also then use, you know, a weapon that you know, you can just sit there and mash and get quick strikes in until, you know, exactly when you need to stop and go away. I don't have to think about committing myself to attacks too much just because they're all so fast.
Yeah.
And always find myself with enough stamina to roll away, at least so far.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's the weapon and build ish that I'm doing. And like I said, the Stormveil Castle legacy dungeon, like you called it, is really, really just peak Souls. Like, that feels good. That's everything I loved about the series. But you know, you kind of start in this open world setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I like mounted combat. It is a very different way to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't use lock on. I'm doing passes like you would on a horse. And it just, you know, that feels very refreshing and very new. But at the same time, it gives me so much flexibility to just run away from anything.
Yeah.
Yep.
That it feels like the stakes are way lower when you're in the open world. And that's probably something you want, because I, you know, I want to have the ability to explore the open world. And for that to be the case, I don't need, or I need every step to not feel like it's, you know, putting me in mortal peril.
It's like when, okay. Oh, go ahead.
Instead of the oh shit moment being like, oh, I missed a block or I missed a roll, it's like, oh shit, they knocked me off my horse. Now I got to fight them.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they want to stop you, they'll put something there that'll stop you.
Yeah. I noticed the tooltip early on said like, oh, if your horse dies, you can resummon it at the cost of a mana flask. However, I've never had trouble resummoning my horse.
It depends on if you are in combat when it happens or not, and that also is weirdly sloppy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because there's definitely times where it's like, well, I'll hit the button, but I don't feel like I'm allowed to, or I know I'm out of mana flasks, and it still works. And I feel like I'm definitely in combat when it happens, but I can't think of a time where I've pushed the button to resummon the horse and it has not popped back up.
So. What's your summon for the ashes?
Summon for the ashes. Say more.
Ooh, maybe that's a mechanic you haven't interacted with yet.
Go back to the church that's right out in front of the opening area. The church of Ella.
The bell thing you can ring and summon it. Okay, yeah. Right now I have the wolves. I also got a jellyfish, but I never used it. I've just been happy enough with the wolves to be like, meh.
Okay. The wolves are good. The jellyfish is good because the jellyfish has a lot of HP and will stick around and provide a distraction for you.
Yeah, Dave and used the jellyfish quite a bit for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why I like NPC summons as well. Mm-hmm. It's just purely for that distraction and HP sponge. And you know, I've used those in every single boss fight I've encountered. It's a great effect, and it's almost like easy mode for the bosses because you have way more ability to just stand there and hack away than you ever would if the boss's attention is on you.
No.
But yeah, so this open world thing is weird. The exploration is just at a higher speed and lower fidelity, it feels like. And, you know, it still feels designed like, you know, there's that kind of thoughtfulness to every place, but it's just happening at a macro level that that is weird. Again, not bad. I just don't quite know what to make of it yet. I will say the most interesting thing that has happened is, you know, I got through Stormville. I went back to just, you know, check in on some stuff in Limgrave, and was going south to a castle and came across a well. Mm-hmm. Hopped in that well and went down to a completely other area that is on a different map from everything else.
Oh man, that is my favorite moment. There are a lot of really good moments, but like, this is going down for a while, huh? This elevator, huh? Wait a minute, what? Oh god, I'm in the Underdark. Okay.
It's almost like the Dark Souls, you know, 2 minds are like, oh, you want an elevator? I'll show you an elevator. Let's go. this is an elevator that goes down so long it's up. Versus the other time. So yeah, and then so, but again, I had my horse, and so I had no fear. Excuse me, just charging into that new area and covering a vast amount of ground without fighting anyone. I just ran away from everyone and picked up probably like 15 items. Got as far as I could in it until I needed a stone key or something like that I didn't have to activate what looked like another elevator to go back up. So I'll go back once I have a key for it, but like that kind of off the rails exploration would never happen for me on foot. Yep. Just too scared, not going to do it. I will poke at the edges of this. And what, I mean, it was still probably a solid half hour of play exploring this area. I mean, that would probably have been like 3 days worth of exploration if I had to do it on foot.
Yeah.
Because everything is so much scarier. So it's a really cool moment to be able to find an area that vast to explore and then explore it at speed. It doesn't feel like that talks to the other portion of the game, the legacy dungeon portions of the game. And not that it has to or whatever, but it just, that's the weird thing.
That's a disparity that exists. But I think that if you're feeling it now, it might go away over time.
Yeah,
I would say a good way to pilot this game is if you're not sure where to go, just ask someone who's played the game instead of looking up a map. Not looking at a map is a really positive thing you could do for yourself playing this game.
Really?
Yeah.
Even the in-game map or?
No, you can look at that.
Yeah.
Okay.
For reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, other open world shenanigans is, you know, I found a candle in the woods, and but it was during the day, and things had come back at night. So I did. And then I followed a ghost guy for a while, and he led me to a place that had a giant bear.
Yeah.
that I died to a lot.
Rune bears never get that much easier. Yeah.
No. I don't quite know what I, you know, I haven't killed the bear yet. So unless there's a prize waiting there, I don't know what the ghost guy was leading to.
Oh, there's a treasure under those ruins.
Oh, under the ruins.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. Okay.
that bear.
I can go under now. Yeah. So yeah, I gotta figure out that bear. But yeah, it just that's the kind of play that I love in open world games, where it's just like, I forget what I was doing here, but this is all like daisy chaining together in a really fun and interesting way. And you know, the Elden Ring is executing that well. And it's got the primo souls in the various bespoke areas, so I'm enjoying it.
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah, that is a lot of words spilled on Elden Ring for a network that already spills a lot of words on Soulsborne games.
You have,
expect more from me on that.
You have real cool stuff ahead of you.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah.
Just hearing you talk about it makes me want to go play it again.
Makes you want to go watch me play it. I know how you operate. let's see. So yeah, any other questions about Elden Ring before I zip through some other stuff?
Zip, zip, zip.
All right. I have more stories from DMZ to share, and they continue to be incredibly wholesome. Like, this is the most wholesome Call of Duty game I've ever played. You actually get to a point in the missions when you're dropping in DMZ where one of your missions is extract dog tags, and that's, you have to get those off of other operators by killing them. And so this is like the one time that you have to engage in PvP. And so I had that in my mission log. You can choose not to do that one and do other missions, but it seemed like the most expeditious. We're towards the end of a drop, and my squad has actually gotten some really good equipment, so we're feeling strong. And we notice that the weapons case, you can always see that on the map. It's like a high value objective, is right next to extraction. We're like, some squad is trying to extract with the weapons case. So this is our moment. This is where I'm going to get my dog tags. We're going to charge in on this squad that's trying to exfil and you know, take them out, and then we're going to get the dog tags and the weapons case. And so we psych ourselves up, getting our you know, Humvee thing and charge in, guns blazing at this bunker that they're in, and we get there. And we realized they're actually already dead. The AI has killed them. Their bodies are just lying on the floor. We did not put a point of damage on them. And these poor people had dropped their weapons case, you know, right next to extraction because of bots. And so I got my dog tags, got the weapons case, and got out without actually having to fight anyone. So even the PvP winds up not being PvP. What is this game? Yeah, love DMZ.
Have you almost held up any other people?
I think as people get familiar with the systems, I've now more frequently like officially joined squads. So there's plenty of times where you just like will talk to someone or interact with someone, then you go your separate ways. But you can actually send an invite and combine squads into like a 6-man group. And normally squads are 3. And so that seems to be happening more and more frequently. But yeah, there's definitely been moments where, you know, you're kind of talking to the people and you're in a little bit of a standoff, like, okay, I'm sending an invite, you accept the invite. And it's like, well, so I sent the invite to you, you accept the invite. And then, so someone winds up pulling a trigger and everything goes to shit. But yeah, so it's those kinds of things. Everyone kind of knows the score a little bit more in terms of how to just interact with other people. Yeah, so it's fun stuff. That's DMZ. It's a new year, so Trackmania has a new campaign out. So that's 25 new tracks for my favorite racing game. Mm-hmm. And I've been burning through those. They put out a bunch of new items, but it's almost all cosmetic items. And so it feels like, you know, it's a new campaign and new content. That's great, but it doesn't have that like sea change feel that when there's a new surface introduced or something like that. It's just more of the same, but prettier.
Okay.
So, you know, as long as that, you know, you don't go too many seasons in a row without anything new to speak of, I'm fine with this every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get author times for most of the tracks faster than I have been in the past. I don't know if that's because I'm getting better or if the author times are easier. Maybe a little bit of both.
Are author times the super secret ones that they don't advertise, or right. is there one mm-hmm. beyond that?
There are technically ones beyond that, but the author time is the traditional one that they don't advertise.
Gotcha.
You can download a mod that then has even more super secret times, which is funny since you actually have to, you know, download them. But yeah, so that's Trackmania. Any questions on DMZ or Trackmania?
No.
Cool. Last one is a little off kilter because it's for my digital pinball table. We got the Dr. Seuss pinball table collection.
Okay.
Which has a Fox in Socks, Cat in the Hat, and then very timely, a Grinch pinball table.
Okay.
Nice.
So yeah, that's very fun. All three of them are really strong. They definitely lean into the Seussian side, where especially the Cat in the Hat, it feels like the ramps are all crazy and just the you know, there's several layers to the table, and so it feels like pinball, a pinball table that Dr. Seuss would design, not just a regular pinball table that has been skinned with Dr. Seuss. And then the other thing that's nice, that the most of the tables have is typically, there's a set of missions and you have to complete some objective to activate the missions, before you can start going through them. And depending on the table, that objective could be really easy or fairly hard. In two of the three Dr. Seuss tables, you just start with your missions. Well, I think so in the Grinch, you just start, you're going, you're in the mission and that's the entire time. You don't have to activate anything. You're in the mission. Fox and Socks, there's like one button that you have to press. So the easiest mission start that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And you're off. And that's kind of nice. Like, you know, as you learn a table, you're focusing on the missions anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And to just have them, minimize the friction to getting into that part of the game is a good consideration.
Nice. I mean, it's good that it sounds like they're balanced for younger players. I mean, have the kids played and enjoyed it at all?
Yeah. We do, you know, whole family pinball a lot. In fact, what we just recently, I'm looking at it right now. We bought a little whiteboard, to hang above the pinball table where we write our scores for a table each week. So I put the name of every table, into an Excel sheet and randomized it and then put dates next to it. So we have a table of the week for the family.
Oh yeah. Like a bounty kind of thing.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm, exactly. So right now Jen's score is higher than mine. I got to work on that after we finish podcasting. but yeah, Dr. Seuss tables, I have been very happy with.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. So that's me. That's, a whole bunch of fun stuff. Holidays were kind to me gaming wise, and I'm enjoying it.
Nice. I'll do mine. I have played a few different things, but only one that I've completed and feel like talking about as of right now. Over the break, over my week off, I played and beat Life is Strange True Colors.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, Life is Strange 3, kinda. It's weird that they didn't decide to call it that. Ben, I know you have played Life is Strange 1 at the very least, right?
Yes. Yep.
I can't remember. Jal, I don't believe you have, and Dennis, I don't believe you have.
Nope.
Okay. Mm-mm. Yeah. So these are cinematic adventure games. Think like a Telltale style thing, where you are playing as generally across them, you're playing young people. Who are in kind of a dramatic life situation, and also they or someone they know happens to have these, basically X-Men powers, right? So in the first game, it was your main character had the ability to rewind time a little bit. In the second game, your younger brother had telekinesis, And in this one, you're playing as a young girl, or not young, so you're playing as a young woman, rather, like, you know, post-college kind of age, named Alex. She has had kind of this troubled past, you know, grew up recently without parents and was knocking around the foster system. And she finally tracks down her older brother to this, frankly, just absurdly idyllic Colorado town called Haven Springs.
you know, there's a murder cult in Haven Springs.
We'll get there. But we won't. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about this, honestly, because this is so story focused. I just want to kind of speak in broad strokes, you know, roughly in the context of the series. Mm-hmm. When I say this is absurdly idyllic, some of this feels a little bit like an overcorrection from Life is Strange 2, which I really enjoyed. Maybe even an overcorrection from Life is Strange 1. With the first game, people said, hey, all these high school kids that I'm with are just shitty and I hate them.
That's high school, baby.
Yeah. I mean, and then Life is Strange 2 is just like, you're not staying in one place for very long, but it is just unrelentingly bleak. Terrible things happen to these brothers. In this one, the characters are broadly very, very likable. To the point where it's kind of hard to identify who the villain might be, as it is. Instead of being this kind of road trip story, like two, it is going back to, you are in, you know, kind of a fixed area. You know, you are in this town, kind of exploring it and places around it, interacting with its limited cast, similar to the boarding school stuff in Life is Strange 1. The power in this one, I was initially a little bit kind of about the idea of it, because like, how is that a thing? How is that mechanical? Your character, this young woman named Alex, has the psychic power of empathy. is how they described it in marketing. In reality, it is like a form of telepathy. It's like she's an empath. So True Colors, the idea being that she has the ability to, when somebody is feeling strong emotions, it is visibly indicated by the color of aura around them. And if it's especially strong, she is affected by that emotion herself. And you think, okay, good.
Does it come off kind of like the Dead Zone, where it's like, oh, I know their past? Yeah.
I mean, to a degree, a little bit. It's kind of like the Dead Zone / Insomnia. Okay. Maybe a couple of other Stephen King things, because he's very preoccupied with psychics. But it actually ends up being pretty cool, because like, yes, okay, is this character mad or not? You can kind of tell by the acting and the way they're written, but like the way that it manifests when you get into particular scenes with people is you're doing almost like detective work by taking on their emotion, and then the scene changes around you and you are looking for details in it that inform the way you try and talk your way out of the situation to kind of get what you want, or to stop things from going especially poorly, things like that. So yeah, like it ended up being pretty cool and playing really nicely with kind of what the game especially was in the first game, which was kind of like a very gentle investigation. You're trying to solve a mystery. Mm-hmm. Here you are also trying to solve a mystery. There's a tragedy that happens, pretty early on that sets off the events of the game, sets those into motion. Mm-hmm. Good.
Are all three games independent character wise? And I don't know if that's a spoiler or not, but
there's a little bit of crossover, like in Life is Strange 2, you will pop by Arcadia Bay. Okay. or what's left of it, depending on which choices you brought forward. One of the characters, a major character in this, is carried forward from Life is Strange Before the Storm.
Okay.
Which is nice. That was a character who was pretty well beloved, and she's cool here as well. But like, as far as a macro story that connects all of these mutants, they don't really know about each other.
Okay.
Now, is there ever a scenario where you would be okay, or even recommend someone jumping straight into a later game in the series, or is it still kind of the situation where it's like, all right, just go back and start from the beginning if you want to get into this kind of game?
I mean, I would say play any of them. I would probably recommend playing one before I play Before the Storm. Just because having context for those characters is pretty important, I think. Even though Before the Storm is a prequel, I think that specifically the character of Chloe is such a standout that getting to spend more time with her will be motivating, let's say.
It's like saying that it's okay to start with The Phantom Menace because it's a prequel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. but you could also do it the other way around. I played the first one before I did the others, but like Life is Strange 2 and True Colors, they're both different enough, and you know, they all follow a pretty standard template, you know, in terms of teen drama powers kind of deals, so yeah, I would say any of them would be a pretty good place to jump in.
Do you think they're building the Life is Strange universe and they're going to have like Professor X swoop in and then unite them all in one mansion in a later game?
I don't know if this one sold well enough for them to continue the series. Oh, actually. No. Yeah, it went on discount pretty quickly. But I've got no idea. Square Enix is kind of a mess. So,
Talk about that in a little bit.
Yes. I dug it. You know, the story is very affecting, even if it does end up being a little bit rote. I really enjoy the character of Alex, you know, playing somebody who is a troubled youth because of these, you know, empath abilities and not really recognizing what they were, trying to settle down and find a home in this place is especially nice, you know? I think it's pretty well done and put together. I was happy to spend my time with it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Are there any kind of threads put into it hinting at future entries?
No. I would be totally fine if none of these ever connected to each other. If they just found different premises, you know, for these, next one's going to be set in Florida. Cool. Let's just do it. Yeah.
I feel like everything is so universed these days.
Yeah.
That you have to actively try to keep something standalone. Mm-hmm. Like there's a gravity towards, well, you know, maybe just hint at something might go this direction or, you know, put in something to get people coming back for the next installment if there is one.
Yeah.
It's appreciated.
I talk about those Benson and Moorhead movies that I like quite a bit. The Endless, Something in the Dirt, Resolution, and you know, indie horror movies. One of the directors of those, Aaron Moorhead, on Twitter, you know, because somebody asked, like, hey, do I need to know about the previous movies to come in and get this? Like, how much continuity? I really like the way that he described it. Like, those are in a shared universe, but like they just kind of glance at each other across the room as opposed to being like all up in each other's business. So like you don't necessarily need that. That is there. That stuff is there for like big fans and also kind of just for them to put it in there. I am really happy with Life is Strange if these just keep glancing at each other across the room.
Nice. How long did it take to beat?
Probably it's five episodes, probably 2 hours and change for each. So somewhere around like 12 hours.
Okay,
cool. Mm-hmm. And what was the price? I need to do my calculation for this game.
I think I got it about a year ago for $30.
Yeah. It's like 24 on Steam right now.
Yeah. It's neat.
Okay. Time value of money calculation.
Yeah. Any other questions about Life is Strange, True Colors?
That sounds cool.
Cool.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where normally we ask you a question and then you answer, but I threw up a last minute free play for folks where you turn it around and you ask us questions and then we answer. So I'm going to get a start. We have four of them here. Greg writes, do you have any gaming traditions? For example, a game that you play on a certain holiday or do not play a game that you don't play at night, for example. Yeah, we've kind of codified this with Watch Out for Fireballs, and when you've been doing it for about 10 years, it eventually becomes a tradition, you know. But like we started doing like a summer JRPG because both Gary and I would play, you know, spend summers playing, you know, JRPGs, a Final Fantasy game or Breath of Fire, or, you know, stuff like that. Like just it made sense for that. that goes back. So like those are the ones that I do, but it's kind of a ritualized version of a thing that was a little bit of a tradition that I just did for funsies earlier.
Can I talk about one that I am kind of starting this year?
Sure.
Okay. My new one, so weird to call it a tradition, but is that I will play the hot new PS5 title when it comes to PC.
Why not?
Yeah, that's going to be my tradition.
Jala, how about you?
No.
Okay. not even like an old one that you kind of fell off on?
Nope.
Okay. Ben, how about you?
I got a weird answer for this one that I'll overshare a little bit with. Whenever I have a date at like my apartment, if I'm like making dinner or something, I will make the person play The Witness and see how they react to it. It's like, you know, like running into a puzzle or something like that.
And Ben, how are you single?
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, I wonder.
That's really funny.
I actually do have a real one, which is I have a group of people that I'm playing through Tiny Tina's Wonderlands with. Mm-hmm. And it's four of us, so it's a full stack, and we do not play the game apart from that group. And whenever we play together, you always load in on the save of whoever is furthest behind. And so you just kind of cycle that way and keep everyone together.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. Like nice little greasing the rails for, you know, the group. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. Patrick writes, what's the best or worst holiday themed game that you have played? DLC counts.
Oh,
I don't know if it's the best or the worst, but it is the most explicitly Christmas based game that I believe I have played. Jala, you'll know this one. Christmas Nights.
Yeah. That one's okay. It? I was thinking about that one, but that one's fine. I mean, it's very overtly, obviously Christmas, but it's just a
demo. Like, it's a very limited slice of the Sega Saturn game Nights into Dreams. I have no idea how it was released, like maybe in a Sega magazine or whatever, but like there wasn't an awful lot different. They just kind of changed some of the graphics mm-hmm. and put like sleigh bells over the music.
Yeah. But yeah, at least they weren't like trying to make you pay for like a whole thing, you know?
True. Yeah. How about you, Jala? Played any holiday themed games or DLCs expansions?
I've played some. I can't really say that there's like a one that sticks out in my head like, oh boy, that was terrible. I mean, I recently played that one text venture game that I really like.
Oh, it was like the sorcery.
Yes, it's that open sorcery. There you go. Open sorcery. Yeah. I did play the Christmas version of, or it's not Christmas, it's holiday version. It has mm-hmm. more than just Christmas. It has Hanukkah and Yule and some other things in it as well. That one was actually really good, though. That was the most recent one that I have played. I do not, and that one's fun. I don't know a bad one.
Yeah. Ben, how about you?
I think it isn't the Batman Arkham Knight. Doesn't that start off at Halloween?
I can't recall. I know that Batman Year One is explicitly like that's Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
Or not Batman Year One, Arkham Origins. Yeah.
The part I'm confusing it with is I know you can go to Calendar Man and then whatever the date is in real life, he says weird things on. But I thought it started on Halloween. So that I think that's my answer.
Okay.
It's a tough question. I don't know many games that are that tied to that, like a holiday for a theming.
Yeah. Dennis, do you have one?
Yeah, I posted images of it to the Slack. But in the worst category is the Santa Claus DLC for the operators in various hyper-realistic combat games. So
okay.
Battlefield has one and Call of Duty has one, both named Klaus with a K.
Oh, fun.
So real original guys.
Yeah.
But you can be bad Santa, I guess.
Maybe check and see at what the other guy's doing before you put yours out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's there's only so many ways you can go with Santa Claus, but military.
Right. Yeah. Stocking shaped rocket launcher. There you go.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Let's see. Brian writes, I've been replaying Resident Evil 4 in anticipation of the remake. So my question is, what is the last Stone Cold classic you replayed and how did it hold up for you? Who's played a Stone Cold classic recently?
Oh,
that's the harder question.
Yeah,
I went back to the Jack series not too long ago and played through all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And held up very well. You know, it shows signs of its age just at the level of being a couple generations ago. But I was very happy with the game and the story overall. A surprising amount of skateboard centric content, or hoverboard, I guess, they have in the game. They introduce it in Jack 2 and throughout. It's just like, I forgot how much of the Jack games you spend on a skateboard effectively.
Oh, I can mention, I played the older Samurai Showdown games as well on like the Neo Geo collection on Switch. And also before that, I had played the classic old school original Bubble Bobble with Dave, because I mention that every once in a while, but that's a game that I do play semi-regularly. I mean, not like on a schedule or a set day or time or whatever, but like...
Did you see that was put out on the Arcade Archive? Uh-huh. Like that's... Yeah, was that the version you did?
I don't know. It was a while ago, so no probably not.
Yeah. Ben, Stone Cold Classic.
Yeah, I played Dark Souls for the first time this year, all the way through. So that might count as my answer. That was good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it was in an adulterated form, but like randomizers do tend to kind of lay open stuff that you already liked about the games you're playing that are randomized. Like, I was pretty shocked at, even with all of the stuff, you know, screwed around with, Resident Evil's 1-3 and 4 were as playable and as fun as they were, outside of even just the like, I'm laughing because that shouldn't be there, or because I'm, you know, getting just my face pounded by 3 Mr. X's on a dumpster.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the amount of enjoyment you can get from a randomizer is directly proportional to how able you are to run away from combat.
Well, yes, at least in those. Also in the Dark Souls one. Also in the Elden Ring randomizer.
Or how likely are you to be a bush that can sneak up on other people in the randomizer.
We got a last one here. Callum asks, what dead franchise would you like to see revived, if any?
Grand Theft Auto.
Boom.
Yeah. Breath of Fire.
Darkstalkers.
All right. Can I say Rayman? It kind of got a reboot, but it's been how long since we had a new game?
It's been almost a decade. Like, yeah. For a mainline Rayman? Yeah.
Yeah, that would be my answer.
I think that counts. Nice. Well, thanks, everybody. If you would like to participate in these in the future, go to facebook.com/thelevelpodcast and watch them to go up on Monday afternoons.
The end boss.
Now it is time for the end boss, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games around us. Dennis, you had mentioned the Square thing before. What are they digging in deeper on?
It's not hip to be Square Enix. You're welcome. They decided to start the new year by doubling down on blockchain, even as it is just imploding on a massive scale and being revealed to be the grift that it is. Square Enix came out in their update and affirmed first thing in 2023 that they are standing by it and have original IPs under development for it and are just hyper, hyper all about this thing that they should not be. So
the corporate equivalent of Slowpoke.
Yeah. it's hard to watch because, you know, Square Enix has a fair number of things that I like.
Yeah.
Just man, they really want to chain themselves to that giant boulder that's been thrown into the ocean.
I mean, chain themselves to the blockchain.
Yeah.
Wasn't, I mean, I just, that wasn't even like a pun.
Just like why? Who? What bubble are you living in where this is still a good idea?
I don't know. Oh gosh! And they're saying like maybe this controversy will help straighten the industry out and lead to more transparency for all.
Gamergate was about journalism, guys.
Jeez, how miserable! Let's see here. Turning away from the miserable, what seems like it's going to be pretty delightful?
Well, Universal Studios Hollywood is opening up a new feature called Super Nintendo World on February the 17th. It's an immersive mini theme park with rides and AR where you can complete four different tasks to obtain keys that will allow you to play boss battle. The interactive games are physical, like running to turn alarm clocks off before the piranha plants wake up and eat you, hitting a series of boxes to change the colors before the timer runs out, etc. And part of the point is that players need to try multiple times to get it, just like in the video games. And for $40, players can also buy a special wristband that pairs with the Universal Studios Hollywood's app and keeps track of scores and number of keys obtained, and it also apparently pairs up with home systems. Don't ask me what it's supposed to do. I don't know. But it's a neat little dongle on your wrist that has a big M for Mario. Other aspects include punching question mark blocks to collect digital coins and interactive binoculars that use AR. There's also a Mario Kart ride where players wear AR goggles and drive a course in four-person vehicles trying to win the Golden Cup. It also will include a retail store, the 1UP Factory, I don't know what that is, and a sit-down restaurant called the Toadstool Cafe with menu items like Super Mushroom Soup, Piranha Plant Caprice, Mario Bacon Cheeseburgers. I don't know how that tracks.
made out of real Mario.
Yeah, well, and Luigi Pesto Chicken Burgers. And Princess Peach cupcakes. So if we're going with all that, then you can eat Princess Peach's cupcakes. Anyway, all right. Admission is included in the Universal Studios Hollywood general admission. But anyway, it sounds pretty legit, and it looks like it's going to be fun. Just from reading the article and looking at the little preview video that I saw in said article. So.
It looks pretty rad.
Yeah.
I just can only imagine me being a kid and rolling up to that. Yeah. Oh, man. And I mean, I also would probably feel like rad as hell rolling up to it as an adult, but like, especially, oh, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is why you have kids. So you have an excuse to go here.
Oh, man.
Who needs an excuse? Just go. God.
Oh, man. Nice. That is good to hear about. Ben, you have kind of a choice here, so I'm just going to let you pick which one you want to do.
I'm just going to let you guys pick. I can either talk about a cool variant of Pokemon or a weird game coming out.
Let's talk about the weird game.
Yeah, seconded.
Weird game coming out is Lies of P. I was looking up videos of just like games that are coming out in the coming year to like see what to look forward. This is inspired by Pinocchio. There's a lot of Pinocchio out right now. But the aesthetic is very far from Pinocchio. It's like this like gothic, dark, like horror type setting. It kind of looks like a Soulsborne type game.
It's Pinocchio Bloodborne, yeah.
Yeah. Very bizarre. This is coming out sometime in 2023, I think the first half of the year. It doesn't have, at least on Steam, it doesn't have an exact date for the release date. But yeah, apparently the main character's nose will grow though if it lies, and that might be a game mechanic. Shrug. don't know.
Oh, yeah. So I laughed at this. It seems ridiculous. We're probably eventually going to cover it on Bonfireside Chat. Mm-hmm. Having spoken with maybe somebody who's... No, I think it's probably just somebody who is a challenge runner, Lobos Jr. We interviewed him for Bonfireside Chat here recently. He said that he has it on authority that that's actually going to be pretty good.
Sweet.
So yeah, I'm curious. It'll take a long time. Basically, I'll have to have beaten it to determine whether or not that concept is too dorky to exist. Like, it's starting out in coolness debt, let's say.
Yeah, well, especially with that name. The Life of P, or the Lies of P.
Lies of P.
You know what happened is the person who had to register the trademark for The Life of Pi went in very, very drunk and kind of couldn't quite remember what to apply for. And they had this name registered. And they're like, we got to do something with it. Someone's got to use this.
I definitely agree alcohol was involved in the making of that game.
I'm going to end on one here that is worth celebrating. We had talked about a little bit of this last month, but it is official. The QA workers at ZeniMax, the kind of publisher that oversees like Bethesda and id and all of that, 300 workers have voted unanimously to unionize their QA workshop. So yeah, 300 people are now under union protection, able to collectively bargain against their management and Microsoft. As a little bonus there, it really seems like the Microsoft Activision deal is basically dead, knock on wood. So not only do we have more active unionization happening, but also a potential monopoly just got busted. So hooray.
Yay. That's good.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything about 2023 being our year. I'm not going to say anything about 2023
it's,
being
it's too
year.
Early. I would slap you if you said it was.
Yeah. So I found out recently over break where it's like the first step is making a union, but then the second step is you need to get a contract between the union and the company. Or mm-hmm. like that's the progression of it. And no union has gotten that yet. Like Starbucks hasn't or the Amazon union hasn't yet.
Yeah, yeah. It might be different with Microsoft at this point because they are under a neutrality clause mm-hmm. as far as organization goes right now. So I think they're technically cooperating without NLRB putting the screws to them on it. We'll see how that pans out. But I am willing to celebrate every small step.
Yes.
Sweet.
Yeah. A question just from my own ignorance. Is there a reason that QA seems to be the place that these unions are happening? Versus other places in game development?
Very bad conditions.
There you go. Fair.
Is my understanding it is they
in an industry that is already notorious for crunch and burning people out.
Yes. Yeah. It's very bad conditions, and unlike a lot of my understanding, a lot of the other kind of departments are on the Hollywood model where it's like, we'll hire you up for this project and then you're gone. And you're off mm-hmm. looking for the next thing, whereas QA tends to be more under the publisher and more, kind of stable as far as like people sticking around, kind of deal. So okay. I think that like bargaining collectively makes a little bit more sense there than it does for other people who are a bit more itinerant.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Cool. Well, this feels like an episode. How do you all feel about bundling it up?
I feel buttons.
But Greta.
and Greta is giving me some ankle time right now. She knows that it is almost the end. Thank you so much for listening to level number 441, first of 2023. We're happy to have you here. If you want to help out the show, you know what to do. Subscribe, leave a rating or review. There's the Patreon, patreon.com/duckfeedtv, and the Facebook page where you can participate in the multiplayer. All of those are things that we appreciate, along with telling your friends. Jala, what is happening on Jala Chan's place?
So the episode that's coming out the same day as this episode is on Heritage and Heredity. It's basically me and a couple of other folks who happen to have kids talking actually more about like how we inherited our cultures from our parents, whatever those cultures may be. And, you know, in their cases, how they try to share that culture with their kids. So there's that. And like, you know, we have some talk about how that culture changes over time, because, of course, you know, your culture is not 100% your parents' culture, and so forth. So that's coming out same day as this episode. And then the next episode to come up after that on the 20th of January is on Vikram Vedha, which is a really badass South Indian neo-noir film that I cannot recommend enough. And it's free on Amazon. So watch that movie. The 2017 version. There's a 2022 version as well that was a remake, a Bollywood remake. But it's not, in my opinion, as good. Watch the 2017 neo-noir film. It's very good.
What's that called again?
Vikram Vedha.
Gotcha. Nice. Dennis, anything to promote with Deca Wonders?
Just to say that in Europe, it's in people's hands. And it has been a surreal and electrifying experience watching people get into the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, really exciting. Shipments should be going out for the US and AU this week. So I expect more of that. But like to have like, you know, the forums on Board Game Geek and people being like, wait, this was in the Legacy Peddler. What how do you do with that? And like conversation there. Or I was surprised at the number of people that are like, all right, I'm starting to work on fan made villains. Here we go. It's like, oh my God. Okay.
Yeah.
It's out there. You can find it on GameFound for right now, and some more cool stuff is in the works. So cool. More on that later.
Yeah, share photos, videos when you get your copy. Let Dennis know you got it.
Put it out there. I've kind of zoned out of social media, so you can put it on the Discord and I'll see it. And maybe, you know, I check Facebook once a week. So yes, nice. Do it.
Cool. And I went to everybody else. Ben, you got anything?
I have nothing.
All right. cool. Well, I've been Cole Ross. My Twitch streams are going to be resuming on twitch.tv/duckfeedtv. That I do those on Friday and Saturday nights. I've been Cole.
I've been Dennis. You can find me on Twitch at Deck of Wonders right now. I was thinking about switching that to Furia Games because that feels more appropriate. But regardless, if you find me under the first one, it'll, you know, switch over when I go to the latter.
Cool.
I'm Jalachan, and any place you might find me, including Jalachan.place, where my other podcast is.
And I've been Ben Merkel.
And stick around for some titles. All right. I have two. I have pumping out bodily fluids.
Oh, no.
Yay.
And I have Moby Dick in the year 5000.
I have two as well. The Susie Inside. And that's high school, baby.
Can I suggest a stylization on there?
Sure.
Exclamation mark.
Yeah, I would. I was thinking about putting that on there, but
it's delivered with the way Ben delivered it with the zazz.
Yeah.
There.
With gusto. I have three, so sorry for being so verbose. I didn't know we were only doing two.
Jeez. Oh, okay.
I have still kind of war criming. I have quoting Jala, no.
That would be probably the absolutely shortest title we've ever seen, if that were.
We would have to try to get shorter, that's for sure. And then the final one is made out of real Mario.
Whoa. So I have four, but none of them are duplicates.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
Whoa.
I got New Year, New Cole. I got a quote Jella said that I really liked, a real ass human lady. I got cock media because it made me giggle and I'm immature.
Okay. And, yeah. I mean, so I know it's like the actual company is spelled Coke, but just cock media.
Well, I misspelled it then.
Yeah. That's fine.
That's not going to win. And then the last one is I got It's Hip to Be Square Enix.
Don't encourage me.
No.
Yeah.
Don't encourage him.
This is the one time I do that, Dennis. Man.
I like no.
I will second it.
Okay. No, it is.
Yay.
Yes to no.
Yeah.
Yes. It is decided.
That's it. The campaign slogan won him that campaign. It's like it's our hope.